I think in the era of the impact agenda, it's a safe bet that we'll see a great many more projects over the coming years that aim to draw lessons for present-day interdisciplinarity from 19th century knowledge organisation. And though I'm going to argue that there are problems with that, I should say that I'm probably going to be, you know, in the queue for that project funding. There are, I think, many hazards in looking to the Victorians for a paradigm of interdisciplinarity as the one culture model which has been so key in much work in literature and science, for example, would encourage us to do. Not the least of these problems is the optimistic belief that a culture which carefully exposes readers to a range of disciplines necessarily creates a shared and interdisciplinary knowledge. So I want to start with a happy piety of just this kind, taken from William Lubinau's study of the Cambridge Apostles. Lubinau is talking about the effects of the two triposes, maths and classics, which of course formed the major, and until the early 1850s, the only BA honours subjects in this university. Classics and mathematics, he says, worked together in a common literary culture, binding together the likes of Tennyson and Clerk Maxwell. This is a classic one-culture claim. We might start by objecting to the idea that people like Tennyson and Clerk Maxwell have likes, people like them, but I think that there is actually a stronger argument to be made here. The idea of a common literary culture binding together maths and classics may conceivably have been true for some of the apostles. But did an undivided culture produced by the relationship of these two disciplines really exist for those undergraduates not included in Lubinau's intellectual aristocracy? The question was endlessly debated by Victorian educationalists, and it spilled over into national discussion whenever Cambridge hit the headlines. It wasn't just an arcane matter of local turf warfare, though it certainly was that. It also went to the heart of Victorian Cambridge's defence of its own idiosyncratic model of liberal education, and had, I think, a modest but telling contribution to make in shaping contemporary notions of how literary and scientific culture ought to be expected to interact. What I want to do in this paper is to use one especially nasty moment in the relationship of classics and maths in Cambridge to outline some of the ways in which this institution and the rest of the country came to adjust their ideas of the relationships between these kinds of knowledge. The moment I want to discuss was named by one eyewitness the slaughter of 1841. Now, before we get to the slaughter, a little bit of background. Until the mid-19th century, Cambridge's BA honours curriculum was limited to classics and mathematics. The university insisted paradoxically on the power of narrowness to inculcate breadth. An extremely restricted range of knowledge was claimed to support the widest possible range of future options for graduates. Cambridge, Oxford, and the public schools were all more or less agreed on the goals of a liberal education. They were to discipline the mind, to teach moral and intellectual qualities which would stand the student in good stead for any and all duties in life. On what we might think of as the unintended learning outcomes of liberal education, such as defending class and gender privilege, the ancient universities and the public schools were almost equally in accord, though they rarely said so. Unlike the rest of the British educational establishment, however, Cambridge gave mathematics a uniquely privileged role in achieving these goals. The Trinity College professor, George Peacock, spoke for most of his fellow Cambridge mathematicians when he wrote that maths forms the foundation of that high character for sound sense and correct reasoning, which is the proudest result of our system of education and the best preparation for the successful prosecution of professional studies. It was the certainty thought to be characteristic only of mathematical knowledge that gave it this unique and indeed pious status. In 1832, Adam Sedgwick told his undergraduates, "To study mathematics, to study this language of pure, unmixed truth, is to be regarded not only as your duty, but as your highest privilege." Subtext, so stop whinging. Outside Cambridge, however, the university's long-standing privilege of mathematics was coming under increasing attack and even ridicule. The University of Cambridge, wrote that arch critic of English universities, William Hamilton, the University of Cambridge must be held to have established and maintained a scheme of discipline more partial and inadequate than any other which the history of education records. So the scene was set for bitter and dogged fighting to reform and to defend the place of mathematics in liberal education. The story of the ensuing struggle to topple mathematics from its traditional place at the heart of the Cambridge Honours degree shows up some of the pitfalls in trying to think about 19th century education in terms of interdisciplinarity. By definition, I suppose, a curriculum containing only one subject, maths, cannot be interdisciplinary, though its defenders argued that in fact it conduced to a far broader and more humane education than specialised, segmented disciplinary triposes could do. More of this later. Let's now get to the slaughter. Picture scene, and this is helped actually by the fact that there's a picture of the Senate House on the publicity for this event. I'm frightfully happy to see that there. So, picture the scene. Cambridge, a chilly Saturday in January 1841. The first entirely Victorian cohort of students has just sat its exams. The names of the newly minted mathematics BAs are being announced in that very Senate House that we see. One by one, the names are called out in order of merit, from the senior wrangler at the top to the so-called wooden spoon at the bottom. But the list is shorter than it should be. 24 names are missing altogether. 25 students out of 130 have failed. As the realization dawns, the audience becomes agitated. They boo the examiners and they erupt into cheers for the students who have been plucked or failed. From a rowdy Senate House, the shockwave spreads rapidly. Within a day or so, the incident is being reported and debated in the national press. Now, why was this set of degree results so controversial? Because they brought to the surface a set of painful tensions within the university itself and between the university and the rest of the educational establishment. The very policy that gave a Cambridge education its distinctive identity, the focus on mathematics, was now in the media spotlight in a way that its opponents had been trying to achieve for years. Half a dozen of the students who had failed had only been taking the maths exams because they were obliged to, so as to be allowed to take honours in their real subject, classics. There was nothing new in this. When the university introduced the classics tripos 20 years earlier, reformers had had to placate conservative opponents by instituting a rule that students wanting to take the classics exams must first pass in mathematics. Thus, in 1841, as in each year for the past two decades, tutors had prepared their budding classicists, as usual, to pass the maths papers. But they could not prepare them for the sudden decision by that year's examiners, two very bad men, Henry Cookson of St. Peter's and Edward Brummel of St. John's, may their names live in infamy, to raise, these examiners decided to raise the standard in the maths papers without notice, making them about twice as difficult to pass as they'd ever been before. The result of this extraordinary decision was that a number of the most promising classics students were not only prevented from taking honours in their own subject, but were forced to leave the degree, were forced to leave the university without any degree at all. Some of them migrated to Oxford, where rumour had it that they didn't cover themselves in glory. Others doubtless disappeared into what we would call non-graduate employment. As well as jeopardising the interests of these unfortunate student victims, the decision also infuriated many of the Cambridge colleges, who saw their best hopes for classical prizes and fellowships humiliated. Trinity, where two of the best classical scholars were failed, was like a little town in an uproar, as one newspaper reported. And in a leap of the administrative imagination familiar from well-publicised QA disasters in universities today, dons immediately became anxious about the effect on recruitment. "I fear we shall frighten classical scholars away from Cambridge altogether," one insider wrote. Not much chance of that, as we've heard from Simon's paper. Outside the university, comment on this incident was almost universally hostile. The Times was very unusual in supporting the examiners, arguing pompously that they had been making a judicious and right attempt to keep the standard of honours high. This report was marked as from a correspondent, and I think it may in fact have been written by a Cambridge Dom. Certainly its argument strongly resembled the one that was later used to defend the examiners in the official Cambridge University magazine. But this Times report was vigorously attacked in a letter published only the following day from an anonymous Cambridge alumnus who condemned this very harsh and unfair measure. And other newspapers were much more of this alumnus's opinion. Many regional newspapers in this period were in the habit of publishing the lists of Cambridge and Oxford results, often with a congratulatory message to local graduates. On this occasion, a number of them added a comment on the anomaly in the results. The Ipswich Journal, to take one example, deprecated the failing of the classic students and the cultural expectation that had put them in harm's way. "It certainly does appear absurd," the report said, "to insist as a preliminary to obtaining distinction in one branch of study, the classics, that a man should first have distinguished himself in another branch, the mathematics. No such condition is imposed at Oxford." Evidently, the Times did not want to be so out of step with public opinion on this matter. By April, it had performed a volte-face, now arguing that the failing of the students was an outrage upon public feeling, and that reaction against it would overthrow the whole system out of which it sprung. Though this radicalism is rather extreme, nonetheless all the reporting that I found of this incident concludes that the rule demanding that classic students first take mathematical honours must be abolished. Some advocate a completely independent classics tripos. Others, including even the Cambridge University magazine, that classicists should be asked to pass only the ordinary degree exams, not the honours ones, in maths. And this was indeed the eventual outcome of the slaughter of 1841. In 1849, a grace was passed permitting students to take classics honours after being deemed of ordinary degree standard. In a deeply satisfying twist of fate, the vice-chancellor under whom this grace was passed happened to be the very Henry Wilkinson Cookson whose high-handedness as an examiner had brought the matter to national attention 8 years earlier. Now, the 1841 crisis certainly accelerated the decline of mathematics' place as a gatekeeper to other honours in Cambridge. But was anything of substance lost with the shift towards separate, independent honours triposes? Had the 1822 rule, in fact, created a kind of enforced, unified culture in the university? Well, practically speaking, there is little evidence to suggest that the students educated under the maths requirement really turned out culturally rounded and fluent in two disciplines. In the year that I've been focusing on, for instance, not much sign of a vibrant common literary culture is apparent, judging by the exam results. On the contrary, the results lists show a fairly rigid separation of good classic students from good mathematicians. The senior wrangler among the 1841 cohort was George Stokes, who went on to become one of the great British mathematicians of the century. Neither he nor any of the top-ranking math students bothered with the classical tripos at all. Of the 37 wranglers that year, only four, all of them from the bottom half of the list, also took classics, and none of them got a first in it. The most successful student to take both triposes was one Charles Sangster of John's, who was 20th wrangler and took a low-ranking second in classics. What became of him? Well, very shortly after graduating, he took a position as headmaster of the Rochester and Chatham Classical and Mathematical Institution, a school whose title very suitably reflected his own dual competencies. So the top mathematicians left classics severely alone. Conversely, the top classicists, the five who took firsts, in classics, were all ranked in the bottom of the senior optimes or the top of the junior optimes in mathematics, that is to say, between 70th and 90th out of 110 or so passes in maths. They were mediocre mathematicians at best, and this mediocrity was fairly characteristic of successful early Victorian classicists. What of the others? Well, as the results were being read out in Sunnet House that Saturday, the heart of one C.W.M. Bootflower must have been in his mouth. Bootflower was a student at St. John's, and he only just managed to avoid being one of the failed students, scraping through as second to lowest in the bottom rank of mathematicians. It would be lovely to be able to say that this narrow squeak of a pass gave the world a brilliant classical scholar, but unfortunately, Bootflower came second to last again in the classics tripos. From this very undistinguished beginning, Bootflower went on to a spectacularly undistinguished career as a clergyman. After more than 20 years in the Church of England, he was still only serving a West Country village of 500 souls. Other feeble mathematicians, however, did rather better in their classics exams. Two of the 20 lowest performing students in maths did manage to get a second in classics. Just before I move on, I want to mention one more student from the 1841 cohort, because he was entirely anomalous in that his name appears in the classics lists, but not the mathematics one. William Henry Littleton, younger son of the Baron Littleton, was exempted as a member of the peerage from the rule enforcing mathematics on classicists. No, there was a sensible reason. The reason was that noblemen were expected to be needed by their country at a much earlier age than commoners, right? So whereas commoners took a couple more terms to complete their degree, Britain needed William Henry Littleton. It needed him, but maybe not as a classicist. His exemption didn't do him much good. He got a sort of middling third in classics. So there is little in this spread of results to suggest that the mathematical requirement created a unified and rounded culture in the university. Of course, the results table alone cannot tell us about the unofficial education that was learnt but not taught in Victorian Cambridge, which almost certainly produced far more mixing between mathematicians and classicists. That's to say, the much broader reading and talking that wasn't part of any formal course or directed towards an exam, but that some students reported as the most valuable part of their time at the university. A notable example here is that of Augustus de Morgan, who read not only what was required for his maths tutors, but also a great deal of far more wide-ranging mathematical texts, and so many novels that he soon exhausted the stores of the library, as he wrote in his memoir. Of course, de Morgan graduated as fourth rather than first or second wrangler, a lapse put down by his family to his excessively broad education. So here, in this informal education, there was indeed space and time for the development of a common literary culture, such as Leuwenhoek describes. But of course, the early Victorian Cambridge authorities did not cite a putative, unified and interdisciplinary culture as a defence of its maths requirement. Instead, they argued that no one, no matter what his specialist interests, could be called properly educated without the intellectual rigour, discipline, and the strenuous searching after truth that only mathematics could imbue. Whereas for most advocates of liberal education based outside Cambridge, classics built equally good character. Cambridge turned mathematics into what now looks like a kind of fantastical shibboleth, a guarantor of moral and intellectual worth, and an indispensable part of any liberal education. Long past the point at which its own regulations acknowledged the independence of classics and other triposes, conservative Cambridge figures, dominated, of course, by the great and terrible William Whewell, continued to preach the doctrine of mathematics in liberal education. 9 months after the incident of the exam results in 1841, Whewell was appointed Master of Trinity College, in which post he continued what was already a long-running, high-profile and generally successful campaign to preserve the centrality of mathematics in Cambridge's model of liberal education. It would be very nice to see Whewell at the back of this terrible examinations debacle, but I haven't found any evidence to link him with the slaughter. However, Whewell's later career shows him replicating in his own demesne the 1841 examiner's policy. Shortly after being appointed Master of Trinity, Whewell decided to impose higher mathematical standards on candidates for college scholarships, including on men specialising in classics. This move appalled the college fellowship, because Trinity has traditionally attracted more classically minded students, leaving students at St John's to take most of the high-ranking maths places. To insist on more mathematical study for aspiring classics fellows meant risking jeopardising Trinity's superior classical standing. Whewell thought this was a price worth paying for raising the profile of maths, but he wasn't able to persuade his colleagues, and after a couple of years, the policy was quietly allowed to lapse. The failing of the two dozen classicists was an emphatic intervention in a public debate which had been running for more than a decade on the role of mathematics in a gentleman's education. The cursory rumblings had begun in the periodical press as early as the 1820s, but it was the 1830s that saw a particularly intense and often heated controversy about the role of mathematics in university curricula. It's no coincidence that this apparently rather arcane debate took place during the decade of the Reform Act. Indeed, placing this debate in the context of the national political storms surrounding the passing of the bill in 1832 reduces its appearance of arcaneness and shows the debate as part of a far larger reassessment of the structures of privilege in Britain. In Oxford and Cambridge, as in Parliament, these were years of administrative reforms, and the argument about the proper curriculum to prepare young men of the social and intellectual elites for their place in the modern world formed an important bridge between the political struggles within the universities and those in the wider world. Most of the combatants in the 1830s debate on mathematics were also controversialists in university administration. We might think of Augustus De Morgan at UCL or Baden-Powell in Oxford. The universities could be rhetorically presented as miniature states, and their internal practices and external relations understood as reflections or warnings against the practices and relations of the larger country. The curriculum wars, I think, of the 1830s and 40s were in another sense comparable in some way to the emergence of the impact agenda in the present day, in that they were a challenge to the universities to demonstrate the national value of their work, in particular the value of non-vocational subjects. The autonomy of the universities was in this period coming increasingly under question. The argument that the liberal education offered by Oxford and Cambridge underpinned, as Whewell said, the interests of civilization of England and of the world, this argument was turned round to make a case for parliamentary intervention in this education. The kerfuffle occasioned by the slaughter of 1841 made Cambridge's model of liberal education an object of renewed public investigation at a most awkward moment. Most of the rest of the country no longer bought Cambridge's argument that a student was a better classicist, a better businessman, a better Christian for doing mathematics. But it's doubtful whether Cambridge's climb down greatly affected the common undivided culture that Lubernow discusses, because I think that was to a large extent imaginary. Thank you.